From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Imagine turning on your webcam and being able to talk to anyone, anywhere in the world. You can, of course, already do that, but what if you couldn't choose whom to talk to? You'd press a button and find yourself eye to eye with a stranger. Well, that's the high-stakes world of chat roulette, a new viral phenomenon. And to talk me through it, why we should be excited or perhaps concerned about it, is Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered. Omar, welcome back.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And you gave chat roulette a spin over the weekend. Tell us about it. How does it work and whom did you meet?
I did. I'm a little rattled. But Chat Roulette is a service, a very basic web service that combines existing technologies, webcams, connecting on the internet like you do on Skype. But what's interesting about it is that it's completely random. You have no control over who you're talking to, and it just connects you to someone that could be across the world, it could be in your neighborhood, and you really don't know who it is. So when I got on there, I mean, you go through a lot of just people skipping past you as they're looking for someone maybe more attractive or someone that they want to talk to. But I did have some really interesting conversations with a group of guys in Tunisia. I spoke to a woman in Germany. My brother and I found a guy in France who he was wearing a bathrobe and a very short pair of shorts. And we thought, oh, no, this is going to take a terrible turn. But what he did was he got up and he put an extra camera and an extra computer in front of the laptop and created this feedback loop. And he had music in the background. He was sort of DJing for us. So you find these really serendipitous encounters with really cool people. But then the dark side of it is that you see a lot of people doing very dirty things, a lot of web feeds of advertisements, things like that. So just like kind of the old days of the internet where you never knew what you were going to get, it's kind of really good stuff happens and then really, really, really horrible things that you never want to see again can happen.
Yeah, and a huge red flashing light for parents here. There are no age filters on this. I guess they ask you if you're over, is it 17? But there's no way they can screen it out.
Right, and that's how it differs from a traditional chat room where there might be a moderator or you might have to log in first and provide some information, just something basic where they can find you later if something goes down. This is completely, completely unmoderated. You don't even log in. You just connect your webcam, hit connect, and you're there. And for parents, yeah, it can be something I would definitely, definitely keep my kids from because you see a lot of male genitalia. You see a lot of just bad things, very disturbing things. But on the other hand, because it's random, sometimes you come across someone really interesting that just wants to talk. So, but yeah, for kids, definitely, definitely not for kids.
Omar, do you think that chat roulette tells us anything about the boundaries of the internet, where we're headed?
Well, I think over the last, 15 years of internet culture, we've sort of seen things kind of siloed and things become safer and more sanitized. I mean, I'm thinking of Facebook as I'm saying this, where you can actually see the identity of the person. And this kind of goes back the other way. This feels very retro to me, to where there were no boundaries, there were no filters. And in that sense, it kind of goes back to an earlier era where when you went to a web page in 1996, 1997, you had no idea what you were going to get. It could be something horrible. And we've sort of moved away from that for so long with MySpace and then Facebook and even Twitter, where there is some semblance of an identity. I think this is completely anonymous and in that sense is very interesting. But I think something like this, taken to the Facebook level where you could put some filters or could decide, do I want to talk to someone from this country or that country and filter out some of the bad stuff, could be really, really powerful. It definitely feels like the first step of something kind of new and interesting. It just started in November and there's already tens of thousands of people using it. So obviously, there's people out there that want to talk to random people online. And when you combine it with Facebook's hundreds of millions of users, I could definitely see something like this taking off somewhere like that.
Okay, Omar, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. And we will be posting links to photos and information and some kind of amateur sociology that's being done on chat roulette by people on the internet on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
That's Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered. If you've flown recently, given the bad weather across the country, chances are you've spent some time twiddling your thumbs in an airport lounge. Well, we can't do anything about the weather or the delays, but we can do something about the boredom. Here's author Susan Jane Gilman with some recommended airport reading.
I don't have a Kindle, but I do have my pride and pretension. When I travel, I want something delicious and escapist to read that won't insult my intelligence or embarrass me in airports. Thankfully, some smart breezy paperbacks have recently been published that are great alternatives to classic airplane reading, and they have nothing to do with vampires. Elaine Dundy's novel, The Old Man and Me, is far more literary than chick lit, but just as much fun. This reissue of her 1962 classic absolutely crackles with deviousness and wit. It's the story of Honey Flood, a shameless young American gold digger who arrives in England determined to ensnare an older aristocrat. Honey is a terrific female anti-hero, part Holly-go-lightly, part Daisy Miller, but badder, bolder. Want a light, modern on the road? Try The Flying Troutmans by Miriam Taves, a poignant American road trip novel with a twist. It's Canadian. Two highly creative, exasperating teenagers have been abandoned by their mother. Their beleaguered young aunt flies in from Paris to rescue them. The three set out on a desperate mission across the continent. Their story echoes the movie Little Miss Sunshine in that it's a frothy mix of absurdity and family drama in a beat-up minivan. It's easy reading and entertaining. Prefer real adventure? In 1977, Daniel Everett, a Christian missionary, plunged into the Amazonian jungle with his wife and children. Their goal? To enlighten one of the most remote tribes on the planet. This tribe, Everett discovered, exists entirely in the present, without words for colors, numbers, or the passage of time. They have no concept of war or personal property. So, guess what? They ended up enlightening Everett instead. He spent decades with them, and his nonfiction account, Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, is riveting. And it's serious escapism. This book boldly takes you where almost no man has gone before. Yep, that's a Star Trek reference. If sci-fi is your passion, you may be a nerd or just read like one. Either way, there's much to love in Benjamin Nugent's insightful book, American Nerd, The Story of My People. Its history of the nerd does a brilliant job of explaining geekdom and anti-intellectualism in America. There are keen observations about jocks, racism, autism, and, of course, Dungeons and Dragons. While a few sections go off on distinctly nerdy tangents, it's an original, sometimes very funny read. If you traditionally buy self-help books, pick up How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read by Pierre Bayard. Just one read will make you seem infinitely more literate. Bayard's work is cleverer than its title suggests. It's chock full of perceptions, philosophy, and humor. If none of these appeal, here's one last recommendation for hardcore grumps. On the Genealogy of Morals by Friedrich Nietzsche. Okay, it ain't new, and it certainly ain't escapist, but it is alienating. Nothing like brandishing a 19th-century German depressive on an airplane to repel all those cheery chit-chat travelers seated beside you. Bah, humbug. And it, too, is available in paperback.
Susan Jane Gilman is the author of Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven.
Now, 1 year ago this month, Bernard Madoff pleaded guilty to operating the biggest Ponzi scheme in history. He ran his operation for decades, and government regulators never found out until Madoff confessed. Harry Markopoulos knew what was going on. He was a financial analyst who repeatedly warned the SEC about Madoff and was ignored. So now he's written a book called No One Would Listen. The story starts when Markopoulos was working at a financial firm in Boston that was losing customers to Madoff. His boss asked him to replicate Madoff's financial strategy.
They bought into the story. They bought into his patina of respectability, that he was a market maker, one of the largest on the street. They thought he was a Wall Street titan, and they had no reason to doubt him. But they didn't know the math like I did.
And what made it so obvious that Bernard Madoff could not be making the returns that he was claiming?
Oh, in 5 minutes, I knew. I read his strategy statement, and it was so poorly put together, his strategy as depicted would have trouble beating a zero return, and in his performance chart went up at a 45-degree line. That line doesn't exist in finance. It only exists in geometry classes.
I don't want to get too deeply into this, but he had a strategy, claimed to have a strategy of buying and selling stocks in such a way that it would minimize his losses, perhaps limit his gains as well, but he claimed it would lock in a steady, good return that was a little better than the market, right?
He did, but his trading size would have been so large it would have moved the markets dramatically, and we never saw his footprints in the market, which was clearly impossible. He couldn't have been there, and that's because he wasn't.
Meaning that he wasn't trading at all?
He never traded.
It was all made up.
It was all made up, and his story was so fanciful and far-fetched that the SEC should have seen through it immediately, and they didn't. I went to them with it, and I went to numerous financial press, and people didn't believe me because they said it's too big. It couldn't be Bernie. He's too well-respected. Why would he need to steal? He's already wealthy. Now, so they couldn't put two and two together.
Now, you're referring to the Securities and Exchange Commission. They themselves have put out a report on why they overlooked Bernard Madoff and overlooked your tips specifically for so long. The record is interesting. There are some people who seem to have believed you at the SEC and some people who seem not to have believed you. What happened? Why did it take them so long to get around to you?
Well, Boston, the people in Boston knew me. I had worked with the Boston SEC staff repeatedly. They considered me a very good source, a credible source. But the people in New York, they don't trust anybody in Boston. There were regional turf rivalries. They got along about as well as the Yankees and the Red Sox did, unfortunately.
Mm.
And there was no national office of the whistleblower in Washington to referee and coordinate the regions. And so the regions didn't like each other, those two offices, and I had nowhere else to turn.
There was also an SEC official who said later, well, you know, this guy Markopoulos isn't really a whistleblower. He's not an employee of Madoff who's blowing the whistle, somebody on the inside. He's not even an investor who's grumpy. He's just somebody on the outside who's taking pot shots.
That same person in her deposition said that the only way I would qualify as a whistleblower is if I came in with a tape recording of Bernie Madoff admitting that he was running a Ponzi scheme.
And?
Well, obviously, I didn't have that tape, and if I did, I wouldn't have needed the SEC.
Maybe there's a lesson here in how you learn things, because you weren't working with information that was inside in any way, were you?
No, it was publicly available information. My team and I, we used cover stories. We pretended to want to invest in the Madoff complex through his feeder funds, which were the tentacles that were scamming in the victims from around the globe. And we'd ask questions pretending to invest a lot of money, and those feeder funds would tell us everything. They'd open their kimonos, and we get their documents, we get their financial statements, and that's how we pieced the case together.
How did Madoff and his colleagues respond to you over the years, knowing that you were going after them in this way?
If Madoff had known that I was going after him, he would have had me killed. He was taking money from the wrong people. He was zeroing out accounts from the Latin American drug cartels and the Russian mob and other organized criminal elements.
Why do you think he would have had you killed?
Well, if those organized crime gangs had known that he was stealing from them, they certainly would have killed him. And so he'd have a choice. Does he want to live or does he want me dead? And that was his choice, and I don't think he would have flinched for one second.
This is an even more ruthless picture of the man than a guy who steals almost by guile or by charm. What evidence suggests that he was involved with organized crime?
He was using offshore companies called feeder funds. These were companies that were sending him victims on a price-per-head basis. He had 59 different management companies in over 40 nations across the world feeding him victims. He had a massive conspiracy going. He had a lot of people helping him. He did not act alone. And if you notice, he took the full 150-year sentence. He has not cooperated. He's operating under the code of silence, Omerta.
Did you ever talk to the man?
I never met him. Only one man on my team, the investigative journalist Michael Okrant, had ever met Madoff.
Would you like to meet him now?
I've been asked that repeatedly, and no. I think he's a pathological liar. Why would I want to sit there and be lied to?
Harry Markopoulos, thanks very much.
Thank you.
2 weeks ago, we reported that Japan had supplanted China as America's top creditor. Well, it turns out we were wrong. The Treasury Department has revised its data, and it now shows that the U.S. government still owes more money to China than any other country. Adam Davidson with NPR's Planet Money reports.
To be fair, we did say the data was a bit sketchy and would likely be revised. But when those revisions came out, it wasn't even close. The U.S. government owes nearly $900 billion to China and a measly little $765 billion to Japan. We, like the U.S. government, were off by nearly $150 billion. It turns out, unlike credit card holders, the U.S. government can only guess exactly how much money it owes to different countries and people around the world. Governments generally borrow by selling bonds, which are basically an IOU, and anyone can then sell their bonds on to someone else. The U.S. has very little way of knowing for sure where those bonds ultimately wind up. China can buy bonds directly from the U.S. government, but like lots of governments, they buy many bonds through middlemen in London. In part, that's just for convenience. Beijing has more daylight hours in common with London than with Washington, D.C. And in part, it's because China, like a lot of countries, doesn't want its citizens to know just how much it's lent to the not always popular United States. Some say we should be reassured that China has lent us so much. They help finance our ever-growing debt, and because we owe them so much, it's mutually assured financial destruction. If China does anything to hurt the bottom line of the United States, then China's $900 billion could be lost. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. President Obama wants to give almost $1 billion to schools with high dropout rates. But here's the catch. School districts must consider making them charter schools or take other drastic measures, like firing the principal and all the teachers.
That's what happened in Rhode Island last week at a chronically troubled school when just 7% of 11th graders passed state math tests. 7%. When a school board wasn't able to deliver change by other means, they voted to lay off the faculty and the staff.
Although that was not in response to the president's education initiative, Mr. Obama thinks the Central Falls, Rhode Island School District did the right thing. But as Rhode Island Public Radio's Elizabeth Harrison reports, not everyone in town agrees.
Central Falls educators are fighting for their jobs. Teachers Union President Jane Sessoms addressed a crowd of about 400 in this former mill town, where more than 40% of children live in poverty and less than half finish high school on time.
We don't make excuses for anything, but we do have to speak about realities. Children of poverty come to school with a lot of issues.
Central Falls High School serves a student body that is mostly Hispanic, and 40% of students speak a language other than English at home. But after 5 years of state-ordered reforms, just 7% of juniors tested proficient in math this fall, one of the lowest rates in the state. So school officials announced a dramatic new step. They will fire everyone who has a role in teaching at the end of the school year. Math teacher Kathy Luther was outraged.
I've been in Central Falls for 28 years, and I have done nothing to deserve to be fired. Absolutely nothing. I give my heart, my soul to my job, and I don't deserve this at all.
Rhode Island officials identified Central Falls High and five other schools for so-called turnarounds under a federal program aimed at the bottom 5% of public schools. It gives district officials four choices: close the failing school, turn it into a charter school, replace at least half the staff, or give time to improve with a longer school day and more time for tutoring and teacher training. Central Falls Superintendent Fran Gallo says she wanted to give the school a chance, but teachers would not agree to add 30 minutes to the school day and 90 minutes a week for faculty meetings.
An 8-to-3 day is still slim compared to what's expected in all of the successful models that I looked at. 90 minutes a week opportunity to sit in your small learning community groups and build. I did not ask for the world. I asked for the very minimum.
We've always been flexible.
Jim Parisi is with the Rhode Island Federation of Teachers, the union that represents Central Falls. He blames district officials for refusing to negotiate.
The proposal that's on the table today is the same proposal that the school district started with. They haven't budged one inch, and we think that they're doing that because they don't think there's any collective bargaining for teachers anymore.
State officials support Gallo's decision to fire the staff, though up to 50% can be rehired. But students like senior Maria Butzina describe the process as heartbreaking.
The teachers do the best they can. They show up every day. They help us so much. Like Ms. Ivanov, she's here every day after school. She has great bonds with students. I can't understand why they would want to fire. It's hard.
The Central Falls teachers have vowed to appeal the termination policy, saying it violates their right to negotiate working conditions. District officials say they have no plans to return to the bargaining table. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Harrison.
It's only March, but our movie critic is ready to name one of the best films of the year. The French film, A Prophet, has been the talk of the international film world since it won the Grand Jury Prize at Cannes last year. Here's Kenneth Turan's review.
A Prophet is part prison movie, part crime story, part intense personal drama. It's also an answered prayer if you believe that using modern touches to bring new life to old-fashioned movies makes for the most compelling kind of cinema. The film's protagonist is a rootless young Arab named Malik, who arrives at a French prison at age 19 to begin doing a 6-year stretch. Friendless, barely literate, and highly vulnerable in the savage, Balkanized prison environment, Malik gains our sympathy because of the open, vulnerable demeanor of young actor Tahar Rahim.
Vous avez quelqu'un dehors?
Non, chef.
Vous avez personne pour vous envoyer de l'argent?
Non, chef.
Ici, à l'intérieur, vous connaissez du monde, amis, ennemis?
Personne, chef.
If Malik is at the bottom of the prison pyramid, a veteran Corsican gangster named Cesar is at the very top. This is a brutally violent, terrifying man with the dead eyes and quick strike instincts of a cobra. The story of a prophet is the violent tale of what happens to Malik during his 6 years inside as he navigates the equivalent of a postgraduate course in criminal behavior.
C'est à cause de moi. Si tu rêves, si tu penses, si tu vis, c'est à cause de moi.
Director Jacques Audiard has a gift for emotionally powerful storytelling. So a prophet catches us up completely in Malik's quest to come into his own. To borrow a marketing phrase from another, very different film, a prophet really is the movie that reminds you why you love the movies. Especially movies like this one.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times, and we review more movies at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.